Hello, my name is Jim Rockwood, and I'm happy to be with you today to talk to you about the subject of incest and how you as a telephone counselor might be able to help those who call you during one of the Crusades. I began the work in the field of counseling really as a pastoral counselor. I have a degree in theology and later went on to get a degree in marriage and family therapy. And it was through this process of working with families in the church that I became aware of some of the difficulties that families face. That led me into more specifically looking at problems with eating disorders, and from there, in working with eating disorders, discovered that behind many of those situations there has been and is a problem with sexual abuse, and in many cases that's some form of incest within the family. So through that process, I have found myself now, largely in my practice, working mostly with adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse. So from that background, I would like to talk to you a little bit about the current situation with incest, and then talk to you about a definition. And then after that, I'd like to talk to you about how you might be able to help out with the people that call you in the phone counseling ministry. In the last several years, there has been a growing awareness of the occurrence of incest in our society. This new awareness, I believe, is due to several factors. One of them is the current rise of the women's movement, in which women have come forward and have started to talk about many issues that are important for them. And one of those, I think, has allowed them to seek help and treatment for abuse that's taken place in their backgrounds. A second factor involves the greater acceptance of child abuse and sexual abuse on behalf of the psychiatric and the counseling field. For many years, it was not even received or believed very well in the counseling field that these kind of things could be taking place within the family. But we know now, with more and more research and more cases being presented, that this really does take place, and that has opened the way for psychiatric community and counseling community to be more readily available for study, for research, and for training on treatment for these kinds of problems. A third factor, I think, that's been very important as well has been the media. And the media provides, through movies, through television, as well as through the printed page, many stories and true life recounting of types of abuse that people have experienced. So that we are more and more familiar with that in our homes and through the news that this is occurring today. I think these factors, among others, have provided then an openness for our society to hear these stories, that they are believable, and consequently more and more people are coming forth to respond to them. The estimates that are often made about incest is that perhaps as high as 20% of the female population of our country has at some point in time experienced some form of incestuous abuse. For males, it's not quite as clear as the number, and that's largely due perhaps to a societal bias that prevents males from actually coming in for treatment. It may seem like a weakness or a failure on a man's part to have to seek some kind of help. And I think oftentimes these types of individuals may find themselves dealing with their pain or their problems through alcohol or some other form of addiction rather than coming in for treatment. Yet even with all of the new openness, if you will, to this problem in our society, there are still a great number of cases each year that go by unreported and undealt with. So as we look at this today, I would like to offer a definition about incest, and then I would like to talk about the process of recovery and what you can do, again, as a part of the Billy Graham Crusade. In the book of Leviticus, we find a reference to incest in the 18th chapter, and I'd just like to look at a couple of verses here briefly to say that this is not a new problem for our society or our culture. Basically, it has been around, I think, from the beginning of time. And in Leviticus chapter 18, verse 6, the word says, "No one is to approach any close relative to have sexual relations. I am the Lord." And then throughout the rest of the chapter are various ways of describing the types of incestuous relationships that could occur, and that those are all laid out there in this chapter. And then as the author reaches the end, down in verse 29, there is a consequence to this that God expected out of the nation of Israel. And we also see that the cultures around them were practicing these things. Verse 29 says, "Everyone who does any of these detestable things, such persons must be cut off from their people. Keep my requirements and do not follow any of the detestable customs that are practiced before you came, and do not defile yourselves with them. I am the Lord your God." So we see from the early on times, as God established the nation of Israel, that he was against this type of practice and against it in the cultures that surrounded Israel, and that he did a desire to see some kind of punishment carried out that would eliminate or remove the people that were guilty from the congregation of Israel. So, as I said, this is not a new problem, but something that's been around for centuries and centuries. Looking more at a modern definition, perhaps, according to Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, he simply defines incest as sexual intercourse between persons so closely related that they are forbidden by law to marry. So this is similar to what the scriptures have had to say, any close relative to have sexual relations. In the work that I've done, I've found that Webster's definition of limiting intercourse to just simply sexual intercourse has really not taken into account many of the things that happen within families that produce these kind of problems and pain in people's lives. More importantly, I think, than just looking at sexual intercourse as the problem, is to allow for any type of deviant or inappropriate sexual behavior or attitudes to be a part of that incestuous problem in the family. Now, these can be overt types of behaviors or covert types of behaviors or attitudes. When I say overt, I'm thinking about things like incest, or the intercourse itself, or fondling, or different types of physical touch that can take place within a family in inappropriate ways. Or the abuse can be more covert or hidden away through such things as degrading sexual conversation or remarks or jokes towards someone, or even a leering type of look. Now, it's one of the ways of determining oftentimes if a person has felt abused in this situation is by their own subjective response. Do I feel yucky, or did I feel dirty? Those are common expressions or feelings that people talk about when they have been a victim of some form of sexual abuse. There's this sense of uncleanness that they carry with them quite frequently, and sometimes almost all the time. So in examining this process, that's an important question to ask in determining where a person, or if a person, might have been abused. The depending on the type of abuse that a person has experienced, as well as when it started, how old they were when it started, how long it continued, or who was involved with it, and probably one of the most important things of all about this whole problem is whether or not the victim was able to talk about what happened and to receive help for that at that time. When you think really what we're talking about here are children who have this happen to them, and how vulnerable and unprotected they are for them to go and explain that daddy or mommy did this to me and then have the other parent not believe them, can be a very, very crushing kind of experience. And often when that's happened, then the shame and the guilt and all of the problems that go with incest wind up going within the child rather than recognizing something has happened to them. So this factor of their ability to talk about this with someone else seems to be very crucial in how well they recover from the problem. We know today, in working with children who are presenting incest or sexual abuse, that those who receive treatment and are believed really can come through that very well. They're still young and able to change and understand what's happened to them and let go of the responsibility that many of these victims carry throughout their life. So That is an important and critical factor in all of this. So when someone is calling you or talking to you on the phone and acknowledging this has happened to them, that's quite a significant thing. And as we'll talk about later, it's very important to not overlook the courage that they've had to even say that this has happened to them. Also, a thing about incest usually does not involve a lot of violence. Now, there can be violence in certain families in certain ways. Some of the abuse can get very violent. But by and large, most incest does not involve a lot of violence. There is, however, a very coercive type of relationship within the family itself that takes place that makes it very difficult for a child to understand what's taking place. What do I mean by coercive or misrepresentation of the family relationship? Basically, what I'm saying is that while the child may be being molested or sexually abused, they are also receiving a very mixed message from the perpetrator saying such things as, you really like this, or this is really for your own good, or I'm doing you to teach you this so you'll know how to behave when you get older. So there are lots of different mixed communications that go into this that cause the child to be very confused about what is really happening, because all that while they're being told one thing, inside they're feeling very, very badly, very, very frightened, and very, very scared are all parts of this process many times. So there's a manipulation of this child by the adult who is really much more powerful and upon whom the child depends for their safety and well-being. So the child is caught in sort of a double bind of, here's a parent who loves me and cares about me, yet this is happening to me, and I don't feel good about it. What do I do with it? So again, as I said, if they can go get help for that at that time, there's usually a good response to that. However, if it has to go underground because they're not believed, then it can lead to many, many problems that we see in adulthood. So there is usually an additional element also of coercion by the perpetrator as he or she attempts to keep this abuse a secret. That may come in messages such as, don't tell your mother about this, she will be mad at you. Or even more threatening, I'll hurt you if you ever tell anybody about this. This is our secret and it's just for us. So there are all kinds of double binding in messages that keep the child confused and caught in loyalties. Do I stay loyal to the perpetrator and keep the secret? Do I stay loyal to myself and try to talk about it with someone else? And while I'm relating about perpetrators, I think it's important to know that even though most frequently and most commonly we think about incest as being from a male father or stepfather toward a female daughter or stepchild, that's not always the case. There are also reported cases of mothers who molest their daughters or their sons, as well as fathers who might be molesting their sons. So although we have the more common pattern of male abusing female, that's not always the case, and it's important not to just assume that when someone calls to you that that's what's happened. So from this, I think it's possible to see that incest is more than just some form of sexual act that's perpetrated on a child, but in fact it's a whole system of relationship which controls the developing child's concept of itself and the world around it. We know from developmental theory about children that they go through some sequential types of stages, and one of the very earliest is the question of trust versus mistrust. So when these types of things are happening early on in a child's life, there's a question for them always about, can I trust the world? Can I trust the people that are around it to protect me? And it causes a great deal of confusion. As a consequence, of this, the child's physical, emotional, and spiritual boundaries are all damaged in some way, to some degree. And this comes as the child is introduced into experiences long before he or she is developmentally ready for them in any way, shape, or form. So what are some of the effects that play out in incest victims, either later in their life or even in childhood? One of the things relates to physical problems. And oftentimes there may be a wide variety of problems that one person may have, or you may see many different types of individuals with problems. Some of these include such things as chronic back pain or headaches, nausea, skin problems, pelvic inflammatory disease, bladder infections, cramping, sore throat. This would be sometimes often more related to some type of oral sexual abuse, where they're living or reliving through a flashback or a memory of these types of experiences, and the body is reliving it where the mind is keeping it suppressed out of their awareness. And as I said earlier, eating disorders frequently have this as a part of their background. Eating disorders being anorexia, which is a form of starving oneself, a compulsive form of starving oneself, again, to master control over life. It seems as if, in a way, all of life is out of control, and their food and their eating is one thing that they can control. Or bulimia, which is an eating disorder which involves a binging or taking in a large quantity of food and then finding some way to purge that food, either through perhaps vomiting or the use of laxatives or some other form to rid themselves of the food. And the third form of eating disorder would be obesity or just overeating without trying to purge that. Oftentimes, like I said, then those things are rooted in this incest in their past and the difficulty people are having to control the pain that's going on unconsciously within them. Another area that is affected is the emotional part of a person's life. And these involve such conditions as depression, feelings of inferiority, dissatisfaction with life in general, feelings of powerlessness or lack of trust, feeling detached. By that I mean a person may feel like they're in a room with other people, but yet they don't really feel connected to them. Or sometimes people even describe feeling disconnected from themselves because of this experience. They don't know at the time that's what's causing it, but that is an experience they may present. I don't feel like I'm really connected to myself. There's always, or seems to almost always, be a large component of shame that the person carries within themselves, and a great deal of the treatment for this is helping them to get rid of the shame about what has happened. There's usually a problem with guilt. Much of it is false guilt, as they assume responsibility for what has taken place. After all, frequently they've been told in various ways that this is your fault, or don't talk about it, you'll get in trouble. So again, there's these double binds, as the adult perpetrators don't take responsibility for what's happened. The child will take responsibility, and they carry then this guilt with them. There's also frequently fear of disapproval by others. They may be involved in various kinds of behavior seeking to keep people liking them. Fear and anxiety, panic disorder or panic attacks are also very frequent with this type of problem, as well as repressed anger. And in some of the more severe cases, there are also dissociative disorders and even on occasion what's called multiple personality disorder, which is a coping mechanism to deal with the stress. In addition to physical and emotional problems, there are behavioral and relational problems that stem from this as well. Many times, victims may move into more of a addictive type of behavior or lifestyle. They may find themselves using alcohol, various types of drugs, even painkillers or prescription tranquilizers. There may be cigarette smoking, gambling, and some even move into what's been called sexual addiction, which is an attempt through the use of sex to get their needs met. Oftentimes, victims feel like that maybe was the only time they really were cared about or attention was given to them, and that for a brief period of time, it felt like they were important, even though this was going on in the process of abuse. So that is a pattern that sometimes is carried over into adult life by some people. It appears almost in a way that a person may decide to not have anything to do with sex, or others may choose to just use that as a way to try to get the need met for someone caring, someone being concerned about them, and having some closeness in their relationships. There are also compulsive disorders of various types and sexual dysfunction. Again, one of the more common being a real lack of interest in having sex. This is often seen with couples, I think, not exclusively this problem related to incest, but frequently is seen as maybe there's been some type of a sexual relationship before marriage, and as soon as the marriage takes place, it's like the interest in sex seems to drop off. And that's oftentimes an indicator that maybe something has happened to them sexually. There's also a problem frequently with impulsivity, perhaps spending impulsively and those types of things, as well as difficulty in parenting. They have difficulty tolerating their child's behavior. And oftentimes, as a child grows through the age at which the person themselves was abused, that will trigger many of the same types of feelings or awarenesses that will bring them back into their childhood, into their past where this happened. So oftentimes there'll be this problem with wanting to hurt their child or deal with their child in an inappropriate way because of their desire to get away from the pain of that time in their life. Difficulty in relationships, as well as sometimes self-mutilating behavior. By that, I'm simply referring to such things as taking a razor blade, maybe cutting on oneself, cutting on one's wrist or various parts of the body, using suicidal intentions, overdosing, those kinds of things, and in some cases, sadly, even succeeding in taking one's own life. So there are, as you can see, a variety of things, both in the emotional, physical, and relational areas that affect people. Another area I think is very important, and especially in working with them as you're trying to share Christ's love, is to understand the spiritual problems that they face because of this. Incest damages and destroys all these boundaries around a person, and the spiritual boundary is damaged in that the perpetrator really takes on a very godlike nature. If you can, for a moment, just imagine you have an adult in a very large body with lots of strength dealing with a small child who basically is dependent upon that adult for safety. And the adult then takes advantage of the child and in essence becomes like God. And even though the child's life may not be threatened directly by the perpetrator, to the child oftentimes this does seem like their life is in danger or there's something terrible or horrible happening to them and they can't understand what it is. They only know, for example, that maybe it hurts between my legs when this is happening, or I'm bleeding down there and I don't know what's going on. So they're very confused about it, and here's this adult caretaker who's doing it. So the adult really takes on very much of a godlike nature to the child. So the problem then arises as a child tries to relate to a God who loves them when they've had a parent who's done this to them. And this is even more complicated, I believe, in families that attend church and where the child may go and hear of God's love and then go home and have their father abuse them. It creates a confusion because if they're told God will protect you and not let anything bad happen to you and then this happens, it puts a lot of doubt into their mind about who God is and how does he operate. And I think that's a major area to be worked with any of these victims. Frequently that is a major stumbling block, and you will find that many of them do have a lot of anger about God. Why wasn't he there to protect me? Why did he let this happen? And so the spiritual abuse that takes place is also very critical in their in affecting their life into the future. So again, I'd like to go back. If someone calls you and acknowledges this, they are really taking a big step forward and asking for you to tell them more about God's love. What can be done for victims of incest? And I want to refer you really to the Billy Graham handbook here. There are some very, very excellent suggestions and steps to take in that as you're answering a phone call and responding to these types of people. And that's found on pages 150 through 151. And I would really encourage you to read up on the information that's there. The actual process of recovery involves a lot of undoing of beliefs and understandings about oneself and about life, and it involves consequently a lot of relearning about what life is about. It involves a process of grieving and the process of forgiving. Some of the goals that are worked for in therapy, number one would be hope, and Basically, that would be learning to understand what is realistically possible in life. Many times there's a thing called a bond that takes place between a perpetrator and a victim, and that victim is very much concerned about what happens to the perpetrator, because, as I said before, oftentimes there's a sense of my life is in your hands. So they're concerned that everything be okay for the perpetrator. And this bond can create for the person in recovery a lot of tension within themselves as they're trying to realistically deal with, can I continue to have a relationship with this person? What do I do with my feelings about this person? What will I do the next time I see them? Should I tell them? Shouldn't I tell them? There are lots of things that go on within that relationship that have to be sorted out for the person. And what is really realistically possible is important to be looked at. There's oftentimes also another bond, a fantasy bond, which is the desire that a child has within them, if they haven't had a good family background, to have one, and hoping that perhaps the parent will come along eventually and acknowledge what they've done and be able to make up for it and somehow make it all better. And that fantasy bond is another thing that has to be examined and eventually released. It's as if a person goes through two grieving processes, if you will. One is the grief about what happened to them, the reality of what took place by their caretakers. And the other grieving process is giving up the fantasies that these caretakers will ever be there or ever come and be able to resolve this and make it better. That the patient or the person has to truly take responsibility for their own recovery and not continue to hold on to some fantasy that someone else or something else will make it better for them. Another area that's important to set goals in is the whole area of self-esteem and self-respect. And again, these have to be relearned in terms of what God has said about them and their value and importance to Him. Trauma resolution is another area. These might be around the specific memories of abuse, for example. And these abuse situations have stopped or blocked the child's normal course of development. So consequently, they have to basically relive them many times to see what's happened, to understand who was responsible for that, and to have their feelings be acknowledged and validated and allowed that to be out, so that at last they can really put it behind them. The whole process of recovery involves this idea of moving from I am bad to a place where one can say, I'm not bad, but I've had bad things happen to me. It's a shifting away from the feeling of the defectiveness and the pain to putting it into historical perspective, which allows the person then to go on with their life. Another important step in this, as I've mentioned before, is the whole process of grieving, even understanding and experiencing that normal process, which involves a first stage of shock or denial. Many times memories may begin to come back in the forms of flashbacks, which may be little images or pictures that come into a person's mind. It may come as a voice or a sound sometimes saying something. Or it may come as what's called a body memory. There may be some form of pain or bodily awareness about a past event. And so these things start to come to a person's awareness, and they want to say, that can't happen, I don't believe it's happened, it can't be true. How could I forget something like that? So there's an initial phase of shock and denial that they're dealing with. From there, sadness, depression, anger, all seem to be a part of the roller coaster ride, if you will, of recovery from this process, until finally there's an acceptance, like I said before, that I am not bad, but bad things have happened to me. If you'll simply think about this in terms of a grief process that you may have experienced of losing a loved one, perhaps when you first heard that information, it didn't seem like it could be possibly true. And maybe you felt the sadness of that loss. And maybe you were even angry in a way that you couldn't get there to do something, or you had something you would have wanted to say, but the person died before you could get there to do that. And then ultimately there is a final acceptance, a resolution to the fact that this person has, in fact, died. Now, this doesn't mean that into the future a person might not look back at that event and still have sadness, But the resolution part is that it doesn't become so overwhelming and take control of the person's life where they can't function. And that's really what we're talking about here in the grief about incest and sexual abuse. A person may continue to have flashbacks or memories on into the future at times, or around holidays or birthdays or special occasions in families, that might be a sad time for them, but it won't take on the overwhelming nature of what it's doing during the process of recovery. Forgiveness, as I said before, is another part of this process, and forgiving oneself is often a very difficult thing for incest victims to do. There's a sense that I should have been able to stop it. It's my fault. There should have been some way that I could have done this differently. And so there's a lot of attempts to manage or control what happened by taking responsibility for it and then feeling guilty that they couldn't do anything differently. And oftentimes that needs to be addressed by focusing on who were the actual perpetrators in these events. And that leads them also to at some point have to deal with their feelings toward the offender and the process of forgiveness that's important there. And by forgiveness, I'm not referencing the idea of saying what you did to me is okay, or I've forgotten about it, so let's go on as if nothing happened. But more an awareness that I know what happened, I know how I feel about it, I won't let that type of thing happen to me again in our relationship, and I'm no longer holding you accountable to make everything better for me. That I will forgive you in terms of letting you off the hook, so to speak, in the process of paying for the pain in my life. And another step that's very important is that step of belonging to the human race, belonging to a group, belonging to a family. And this is a step that's very important, because oftentimes victims will feel very isolated, very alone, very abandoned, and maybe even in a crowd of people continue to feel very alone. So as the process of recovery moves on, it is possible for them to begin to feel like they belong, that they belong to the human race, and that they have relationships which are meaningful and significant for them. So, turning to more specifically what you as a phone counselor would be able to do, I want to again encourage you to look in the handbook, and at this point to look under the information regarding child abuse, not incest, but child abuse, and that's found on page 56. And I think that's important to look at that, because in the adult person that's calling you, there is a child that's still wounded. As I said before, these behaviors that take place really stop a child's developmental process. So what many times you'll be dealing with is a child in an adult's body, or at least the attitudes or actions that you may sometimes see. So understanding what's there for a child in this handbook is very helpful as well, I think, in talking with adults. And realize for yourself that you're really talking with someone who has a complex set of emotions and beliefs, and they're really looking for truly a salvation from this pain. And to be able to offer them and share the gospel with them, to offer them the love of God through a relationship with Jesus Christ, is very, very significant and a very, very wonderful opportunity that you have. So when they do contact you, I think the most important thing to start with is really offering them reassurance. Let the caller know that they are not crazy. Many victims have a lot of self-doubt about their experience, and they've already been discounted by many other people whom they've tried to reach out to. So to just be reassuring of them that they're cared about and that they're not crazy can be very big steps in their process of receiving the Lord. I would encourage you also not to use such statements as, well, just forgive and forget, or that happened so long ago, why don't you just forget about that and go on with your life? Because those are, in essence, very abusing kind of statements as well, in that they are telling the person your pain and your experience is unimportant, you should be able to just forget it. And that's really oftentimes what has happened throughout their family and experience. So just try to encourage them, to help them to know that they're not alone in this and that there is help available for them. There are some helpful verses that I've found in working with people. In addition to the sections that are listed in the handbook, and again, I would refer you to that because these different topics are covered there as well. So these verses are some in addition to the ones that you have in your handbook. Number one, around the issue of guilt, I think 1 John 1:9 about the confession of our sins, and 1 John 2:1 through 2 as well, and Isaiah 43:25. These verses all really point to the fact that in Christ we are free, we have been forgiven, and if a person has accepted these things, then they may be really dealing with more of what's called false guilt rather than the true guilt before God, and that can help you sort that through for them. In addition, around the feeling of anger, I think it's important to know that there is a healthy form of anger, and that these people do need to be able to say, I'm angry about what happened to me. We know from the scriptures that God sees this as a real problem, and as a matter of fact, as I read from the Leviticus passage, he sees people put out of the community for this. So there is a right kind of anger for them to have about what's happened, and it needs to be talked about and expressed in appropriate ways. Otherwise, it may lead to depression or other complications for them. So Ephesians 4:26 talks about being angry but not sinning. We have James 1:19-20, and also Matthew 21:12-13, and this is the passage relating to Jesus cleansing the temple. And although the actual word anger is not used there, I think in looking at the description of what takes place, it's safe to assume that Jesus was very upset about what had begun to take place in the temple in his Father's house. And as he turned over the tables of the money changers and things, I think there was a form of anger that was there. So I think it's important not to just shut down their anger, but encourage them to work with it in healthy, appropriate ways. Fear, I mentioned before, and anxiety is another component of this. And oftentimes the fear and the anxiety that starts to surface or be in a person's life prior to having a memory come up can be very, very overwhelming and very, very frightening. It's like something is coming into my mind, I don't know what it is, and I don't know where it's going to take me, and I'm afraid to know. And there's a lot of fear associated with that. And I think the verses of Philippians 4:6-9, Psalm 34, Psalm 37:1-7, 1 Peter 5:7, John 16:33 are all very, very helpful for the person to meditate upon and to allow that to basically be a part of their process of working with rebuilding trust in God and dealing with their anxiety. There are also some verses on God's acceptance. Romans 8:1, I think, is very important, again, that there is no condemnation for those in Christ Jesus. Very, very important, because these folks oftentimes carry with them a constant feeling of condemnation and guilt. So God has accepted them. Again, Romans 8:28-35, explaining and giving us a real important picture of God's unconditional love for us and his desire to be with us. 1 John 4:9-10 are also very helpful verses along that line of God's acceptance. Depression is another emotion that frequently accompanies this particular problem. And for depression, I've also looked at Psalm 121, Psalm 27, and Psalm 40:1-3. And again, to use these as sort of a meditative time, allow the person to look at them and to study them, but to just listen to what God might be saying to them through these verses is very important. And I do want to, again, encourage you that the time when someone calls you with this particular problem is an excellent time to present the gospel to them. They are reaching out, they are aware that they have a need, and this is a very, very important time to present Jesus Christ to them. I would also suggest that as a phone counselor, it's very important and that you really need to document fully any conversation that you've had with someone regarding incest on your report, and so that your supervisors and the center directors where you work can follow through on an actual referral. And I think not everyone needs to necessarily see a professional for this, but I think those that are really struggling with it or feel like they have it in their background could be very much helped by talking with a professional to find out where they really are with it. And I think it's important to find a professional who does have some training and working experience with sexual abuse. Not every pastor and every counselor has a real understanding of the issues that are involved with this. And sometimes if a person is not familiar with it and what's going on, they can actually cause more harm than good and can really set a person back in their recovery process if they're not familiar with what's really taking place. So I would encourage you to really use this time and to take advantage of it. I think God would give you a very special opportunity in working with these people. And to share the gospel with them is a very, very important thing. I just want to thank you for allowing me to visit with you today and to take this time and share with you about this particular difficulty.